We're discussing a new PBS Wisconsin educational video game and how it's a gateway to some learning goals as kids use critical thinking skills to discover shipwrecks in the Great Lakes. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Gamified learning, it seems, is got lots of attention in the pandemic as schools shifted to remote learning. Our kids have appreciated their tech-based literacy and math program supplements. They have game-like qualities to them. Does your child like to play educational video games? Which ones? Do you bring video games into classroom learning? Describe that for us. 800-642-1234. Alyssa Sagong is Director of Education at PBS Wisconsin. Alyssa, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. It's great to be here today.
Well, introduce us to the legend of the Lost Emerald.
I will. I just love hearing you say the title. Doesn't it sound fun?
It
just
does.
From the start? It's a point-and-click adventure video game, and players, especially players in grades 4 through 6, use critical thinking and historical inquiry skills. They step into the shoes of a maritime archaeologist and get to dive underwater and gather clues, and they build evidence and uncover what I really think is the real treasure, which is the stories of shipwrecks that are inspired by real Great Lakes history.
Oh, and there are so many stories about these shipwrecks. That, I mean, you have such a rich material to draw from for your theme.
We really do. And we also have a rich group of people who came together to make it possible. The game was designed by our colleagues at Field Day Lab, our team here at PBS Wisconsin, Wisconsin Sea Grant, and of course, really essentially Wisconsin teachers and students. And so bringing all of those different subject area experts together is how we made a really fun game that over 500 students around Wisconsin play tested during development, and you can play it in both English and Spanish.
I wonder how hard it is to design and develop an educational video game and what kind of work goes into that. What was that like?
Well, it did take a whole community in our case. And part of that is, you know, there would be simpler ways to make a game, but to make a game that really works to solve learning challenges, to get kids excited, to be both fun and educational, takes a lot more thoughtfulness. And, you know, so initial ideas didn't work out and we had to revise them. And in this case, this particular project started with a big meeting at the Wisconsin Maritime Museum, mm-hmm. where Sea Grant and Field Day and PBS Wisconsin came together with teachers and even someone who sang sea shanties to get inspired, to think about where in the curriculum this would fit, what would happen. And following all those great brains coming together, we had an idea, and it was such a great opportunity because thematically it connected to the PBS Wisconsin documentary project about Wisconsin shipwrecks. It's called Shipwrecks! Exclamation point. And there's a VR experience as well. And so a lot of people believed in that idea and were so grateful to the many generous supporters who said they believed in the idea too and made it possible.
And shipwrecks, you know, there are thousands of them in the Great Lakes. And just, you know, hearing the story of Atlanta being finally discovered at the bottom of Lake Superior recently, that too was so fascinating. So how did you draw from those stories to create the video game?
You're right. There are so many good stories. And so that perfectly fits our theory of education, where we think learning is powered by curiosity. If you can inspire that wonder, and there have been so many stories just this year and locally in Lake Mendota, Tamara Thompson, who's a maritime archaeologist from the Wisconsin Historical Society, she found a 1,200-year-old dugout canoe.
Wow.
In Lake Dakota. And so just the excitement of trying to figure out the story of how did this get here, or the wreck that was just found in Antarctica, it really does inspire that wonder. And we have wonderful historical records, thanks to our archivist friends, our maritime archaeologist friends, to find those stories that are going to work along with the game mechanic.
talking with Alyssa Sagong, Director of Education at PBS Wisconsin, as we discuss the launch of their new educational video game called The Legend of the Lost Emerald and what it takes to put one together. You can join in. Do you bring video games into your classroom? What online learning techniques have worked best? And students, what do you enjoy through video games and the subjects that can take you deeper on them? 800-642-1234. So you worked with a classroom to test out this particular video game. What was the response from the students?
You're right. We worked with a lot of classrooms, actually, and I want to give a shout out to my colleague, Jim Matthews from Field Day, who is masterful at creating ways for kids and teachers to contribute their voices and ideas. And so we worked with so many, and one school in particular, New Century School in Verona. They were play testers and made a whole Shipwrecks unit out of the experience. Their teacher, Larry Gunlack, is amazing. Mm-hmm. And he supported them in taking that excitement to practice other sorts of science inquiry skills and data collection, which actually culminated in a field trip onto the frozen lake that I got to attend, where students looked in holes in the ice that ice fishermen made to drop cameras down underwater and see what was down there.
Wow.
And they were telling me, oh, you know, we found these holes that our teacher figured out where to make them because they use GPS coordinates, just like we used in the game. And you could see them making those connections between those skills of making predictions, of investigating and inferring and making sure you corroborate your evidence, right? The first thing you think doesn't always work out when you're in an inquiry process and you have to find multiple points of data to really craft a story that is true and makes sense. And so it was so fun to see that. And I also have a wonderful memory of observing a playtest at KM Explore Elementary in Wales, Wisconsin. And this little girl came up to me after playing the game and she had her notebook in her hand. And she said, Mrs. Sagong, are there places that are by the Great Lakes that my family can go to learn more about shipwrecks? Like, are there museums? And I said, yes. And she started writing down a list of all of the places that she could kind of put on the map for their summer vacations.
Oh.
And so it's been so fun to hear the kid reactions, everything from like, I didn't even know history was so cool, to, well, that didn't feel like school, but I learned so much.
Well, let's take a call now. Aiden is with us from Madison. Aiden, hi.
Hi.
Hi, what would you like to say?
I would like to say that the game that you guys are talking about, I am enjoying it, and even my classroom is. We've been working a lot, way too hard, so we can figure out different kinds of ships that sink in the Great Lakes.
Oh my goodness. So what do you think of the game? What has it taught you about shipwrecks?
They taught me about shipwrecks that there's, different kinds of shipwrecks in different kinds of oceans.
There are different kinds of shipwrecks and different kinds of oceans. Aiden, thank you so much for calling in. We appreciate it. Alyssa, you have a fan.
Aiden, I'm so glad you called this morning. That's so wonderful to hear that you're using the game at school.
We're exploring PBS Wisconsin educational resources for families and educators with Education Director Alyssa Sagong. Students, do you enjoy learning through video games? What subjects would you like to go deeper on? Parents, what educational resources are you searching for this summer? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Alyssa Sagong here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing PBS Wisconsin's educational resources and learning media on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In President Biden's State of the Union speech this month, he said kids' lives and education have been turned upside down
American Rescue Plan gave schools money to hire teachers and help students make up for lost learning. I urge every parent to make sure your school does just that.
Biden also urged Americans to volunteer as mentors and tutors. Do you help out in your child's school? What is that like? What do you learn? What educational resources have helped your child make up lost ground in learning? 800-642-1234. We have PBS Wisconsin Education Director Alyssa Sagong with us for about 9 more minutes. Alyssa, let's talk about that learning loss and the reversal of some of that academic progress in the pandemic. As you work with districts and students around the state, what are you hearing from educators? What are you observing?
Well, that's a big question, Kate. And you're right. The pandemic interrupted a lot of important instruction. And honestly, I'm just amazed at the educators that I speak with every day who are so committed to fostering joy in learning. And they're working really hard to foster and bolster their students' resilience and creativity and their sense of belonging so that they can really thrive. And you know, there was learning that did happen during the pandemic. It wasn't maybe the same that those things that lead to test scores, but they have to address a lot of needs at school. And I see them doing that. And we actually have a blog on our website called AKA Teacher that shares a lot of Wisconsin educator perspectives on the multiple elements that are so important to learning. And so when I talk to those teachers, I feel confident that our kids are in good hands. And as communities, as parents and caregivers and teachers, we all have to come together to support kids to thrive.
The other issue, of course, that comes along with that is the screen time that we've seen in the pandemic, the increase in screen time. How do you grapple with that at PBS Wisconsin? Because, of course, you know, screen learning is very important to you.
You're right. Yes, it's something we think about a whole lot. And there's a wonderful expert at UW-Madison named Heather Kerkorian, mm-hmm. and she these media and children. And what I learned from her is that high quality content and context, those two things combined are what really matter a lot when it comes to learning, especially around screen time. So speaking as a parent for a moment, I'm still learning myself how to be the best media mentor to my teens. And it's something that when we look at creating new content, either at PBS Kids for broadcast or for the games, or here in Wisconsin for local classrooms, we want that to be really high quality and designed with intention, that it inspires kids to turn off the television or get off the screen and go out into the world, which is different than a lot of media producers, right? The idea that The Legend of the Lost Emerald, for example, doesn't take you 20 hours to play. It takes a couple of class periods because you're meant to get these skills that will inspire you to want to go out and find out more about what's in the lakes in your community, or how might you use those skills to figure out your own mysteries. And you see that in PBS Kids content too, the encouragement to, you know, go into your backyard or learn about the people in your neighborhood.
So when you look at these times, what do you think has been innovative in the education setting that was either brought on by the pandemic or maybe expedited by these pandemic times?
Wow, that's a hard question. There were so many different things that were tried, and I don't know if we have a total view of all of those things, but mm-hmm. I think if you were to ask me just within the community that I live and work in, it was relationships. I think that the pandemic did give us an opportunity to try new things and collaborate with people. We started new programs with library staff around the state over Zoom, where we work together to talk about using playful learning and using asynchronous learning or tools that library programs wanted to do to support kids in their community. People came together in new ways over a lot of topics, and it's changed the way that we've worked for sure, able to talk with teachers and kids around the state using these new digital tools that weren't comfortable to people pre-pandemic.
And it's amazing. I mean, you collaborate with so many Wisconsin educators and really getting the pulse on what they are doing, what they're coming up against through PBS Wisconsin Education. I bet that gives you a clearer lens in terms of what areas you should focus your materials on.
That is definitely the goal, Kate. I mean, we don't make things for people without them, right? Mm. And so it's so important to us that we're listening to educators. And in fact, on our team, we talk about the best feedback that we can possibly receive is for an educator to say, I feel heard by you. You listen to me. I feel respected by you. That's our goal in all our interactions, because it's true. We do have so much respect. As I mentioned earlier, what is happening in Wisconsin schools and the care and joy that educators are bringing is a source of inspiration for me. And they're really my heroes.
Hmm. Talking with Alyssa Sagong, Director of Education at PBS Wisconsin, you can join in. What educational resources have really clicked with your students? What are you searching for as the summer nears? How do you make learning fun and spark curiosity with your young ones and your family? 800-642-1234. Lily is with us from Verona. Hi, Lily. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, and I really liked the Shipwrecks game because it had, like, the ships had a lot of cool different things on them, and the evidence board was challenging but fun to figure out.
Ooh, the evidence board. Can you tell us a little bit more about what is the evidence board?
It's where you, once you've collected all your photos, you use, like, pins, and you mark them to evidence to find out which ship it was.
So do you feel like you know a little bit more about thinking critically about something before you know that it's for sure? How has it changed the way you think?
It would, like, you wouldn't know what ship it would be at first, but then you would, like, use the evidence board and connect, like, what was on the ship, what was the ship name by finding a couple letters and stuff. And that really changed how I think for different things to find out what it was.
Oh, Lily, what a great explanation. Thank you so much for calling in. Alyssa, I bet it's really neat for you to hear these takeaways from playing the game.
I love it. I love it that you get to hear it too, Kate.
Yes, it is so cool. So, you know, as you look at summer coming up, I mean, I, as a parent, are looking at what resources are there as students get closer to that time when, you know, they're not in the classroom every day. What should we parents be thinking about for summer activities, for summer resources?
We absolutely have something for everyone. And I'd go back to that comment I made about content and context. I think it's important to know that when you go to PBS Kids, whether it's on the apps or on our websites, that your kids are going to be safe. They're going to have high quality content, and the learning is going to be better if you have a chance to play with them or co-watch something. Maybe you get home from work and can play a PBS Kids game. And there's lots and lots of shows and ideas, also printables on pbswisconsin.org/education. We keep a daily activity calendar of PBS Kids activities. And as I mentioned, we work with a lot of libraries, and I would encourage you to visit them. They are treasure troves of ideas and resources.
I really also like how PBS Kids is a real springboard. I see my kids, well, hey, okay, so you watch a show, but then they're also able to take some of those things that they're seeing and then apply it to some of these PBS Kids games, on their laptops. And that to me is a really neat extension of what they're, you know, what they're viewing to actually make it, go a little further.
I love that. Do they have a favorite show, Kate?
You know, they kind of hop around. I mean, for a while it was Dora, and then it just depends. They do a lot of Wildcrats. I mean, they're all over the place, just as kids are.
Yeah, any Wildcrats viewer can school you on animal characteristics.
Exactly. Well, Alyssa, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Kate. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Alyssa Sagong, Director of Education at PBS Wisconsin. We have a link to the publicly available game, The Legend of the Lost Emerald, and you can find that link at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, we talk with a chemical engineer about a new and somewhat controversial technique for recycling plastic that some say is more effective. What concerns you most about plastic pollution? 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the explosion of plastic pollution and breakthroughs in chemical recycling on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Member countries of the United Nations recently agreed to start writing a global treaty to restrict the growth of plastic around the world. And the historic resolution is called End Plastic Pollution, a legally binding global agreement. Do you wonder if the plastic you put in your recycling bin is actually recyclable? What do you do to know about reusing plastic that can't be recycled? 800-642-1234. George Huber is a professor of chemical and biological engineering at UW-Madison, executive director of the Center for Chemical Upcycling of Waste Plastics. George, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So how bad is the single-use plastic problem? What do you see out there?
Well, in the U.S., we consume 37 million tons of plastic per year. Plastic is growing in both the U.S. and also developing countries as well at about 10%. That translates to each person in the U.S. consumes about 740 pounds of plastic each year. Most plastic can't be recycled because we don't have the technology to be able to recycle it. In the U.S., about 10% of plastic gets recycled.
10%. Most of it cannot be recycled. And so, you know, I really thought there were just seven types of plastic. So you recycle seven different types of plastic, but that isn't the case. Can you explain the challenges of there being so many different types of plastics in our world?
Yeah, it's, you know, with glass, there's just really one type of glass.
Glass is glass.
There's colored glass, there's cleared glass, and they get recycled very easily. Plastic, they're chemically very, very different, so you can't recycle them all the same way. And so that makes it challenging because they're chemically so diverse.
So they're chemically so diverse. What does that mean for recycling then and for your efforts when there are so many different types of plastics out there?
Yeah, so we're trying to develop new technologies that will allow us to be able to recycle all types of plastics. And there's a few different approaches that we're trying. So number one plastic, that's PET. That's the most commonly recycled plastic. That's about 20% of PET in the U.S. is recycled. Number two plastics, that's HDPE. That's about 10% of that plastic is recycled in the U.S. But it can't, when we talk about recycling, it's challenging to get number two to, you can't recycle it to the same quality that you can use the virgin material. So you have to, you downcycle it or you use it in applications that you wouldn't use the virgin plastic from. With chemical recycling, we can make plastic that is exactly the recycled plastic that's exactly the same composition as the pure virgin plastic. So that's a huge advantage of the chemical recycling approach that we're using.
And before we go deeper into chemical recycling, so what I'm hearing you say is when you break down plastic, there is a limit to the number of times the material can actually be recycled.
Yeah, every time you heat up a plastic, you change the properties. And so oftentimes when you mechanically recycle it, you first clean it, mm-hmm. you grind it up, You try and separate it, and then you re-extrude it. And when you extrude the plastic, you're heating it back up, and that changes the properties of it. So even when you make recycled number one plastic, you have to blend in 30 to 40% virgin number one plastic, and then you can put in 50 to 60% of the recycled number one PET. So you can't get 100% recycled PET in your products because it won't have the same quality that you want as the virgin plastics. When you start doing recycled chemical recycling number one plastic, you could do 100%. Now, the chemical recycled plastic, this is all pre-commercial technology that's not yet on the market today.
Okay, so take us into this world of chemical recycling, where it is at, this attempt to recycle the unrecyclable, I guess, if you will.
Yeah, so there's a couple of different approaches that we're trying. One is an approach and industry, several companies are trying these as well. With CUP, we work with about 17 different companies all throughout the plastic value chain. But with chemical recycling, one approach is called pyrolysis, or that's a thermal depolymerization approach. So you heat the plastic up to about 500 degrees C. You heat it. When you heat it up, you don't have any oxygen in there because you don't want to burn the plastic. And then you make an oil and you condense out that oil. You can imagine if you put plastic in a campfire, you see those vapors coming off. That's the oil you want to capture. And then when you make that oil, it's similar in composition to crude oil. So then you can remake that plastic from that crude oil. And that's the pyrolysis, a chemical recycling approach. We have another approach that uses solvents to selectively pull out one plastic from the other. So we could selectively pull out the number two plastics using a series of solvents, precipitate it, and then we have the virgin number two plastic as well. So those are two of the chemical recycling approaches that we're working on.
Chemical recycling requires a large amount of energy. Is that a barrier?
It's actually a lot less energy than's required to make the virgin plastic. Anywhere from 7 to 12 times less energy than making the virgin plastic. So it's energy, the CO2 emissions, environmental impacts of chemical recycling are a lot less than making the virgin plastic.
Talking with George Huber, UW-Madison Engineering Professor, Executive Director of the Center for Chemical Upcycling of Waste Plastics. You can join in on plastics and recycling and what you want to know about the chemical recycling work and research that is underway. 800-642-1234. George, you know, they say the next huge challenge of polymer chemistry, which created our plastics, is learning how to really undo the process by turning plastics back into oil. Is that possible?
Yes, we're doing that in my laboratory. Lots of companies are studying that technology. When you start heating the plastic up to 500 degrees C, you make an oil. And that's very easy to do, actually.
What would you do with that oil?
Yeah, so there's a few different options you can do with that oil. One, you could feed it to what's called a steam cracker. The steam cracker is how you make plastics today. That's the first step in the chemical engineering industry to make plastics. You take naphtha or natural gas, you go to very high temperatures, and you add steam in there, and then it kind of cracks it down to give you the olefins. The olefins are then used to make your polyolefins, your polyethylene, polypropylene. A lot of the other plastics are made with that steam cracking technology. So one approach is steam cracking. You could also feed it to a refinery to make diesel fuel out of it. And there's other options you can do with that oil to make other types of chemicals as well.
Environmental groups have been pushing back on chemical recycling, like the Natural Resources Defense Council saying chemical recycling of plastics is like greenwashing of incineration or, you know, burning of plastic waste. What is your response to that?
I don't think we're going to stop using plastics. We're continuing to use plastics. They're just such inexpensive, versatile material. They're very, very lightweight, which is great for packaging. You don't need to use a lot of the plastic material, but it makes it more challenging for recycling the plastics because they're so lightweight. You go to the grocery store today, the amount of plastic that's going into food packaging has increased. tremendously in the last 20 years. You really can't go longer than 5 to 10 minutes without touching the plastics. There's plastics in your clothing, your face mask are plastics. People are also very concerned with food. You know, we want to eat food that's safe to eat. Plastics help you provide safe food to eat, get the food to the consumer, make sure it's safe and make sure it doesn't have any contaminants in there. Make sure it lasts longer on the shelf, smaller portion sizes. And also with medical use, you know, we like to have medicine that's safe to use, and that's all packaged in plastics.
And so you're really thinking from the mindset that plastics aren't going anywhere. They're here with us. We're going to continue to keep creating and making plastic. You know, what the pushback to that is, you know, here you at the United Nations saying, like, we have to end plastic pollution and really trying to cut down on the amount of plastic being created in our world. You know, what do you see there in that effort to stop it at the source?
Yeah, it's plastic pollution is a huge problem. And that's more with end of life use of the plastics. It's especially a challenge in developing countries that don't have the same waste management practices that we have in the United States. It's even been estimated that a third of plastics leak into the environment. Any plastic that leaks into the environment eventually finds its way to the ocean. The ocean is the world's kind of sink. Even in the U.S., where we have a developed waste management industry, it's been estimated that 1 to 2 million tons of plastic leak into the environment and get into the ocean. So it's a huge challenge to help developing countries have better waste management practices, be able to recycle more of the plastics, and to not let any plastic leak into the environment.
And we say, when you say chemical recycling is really in that research stage, it's, you know, pre-market availability, or I'm not sure how you would say that, but, you know, what is the financial cost to unmake all types of plastics so that they can be reused again? How do you make that financially doable?
Yeah, well, the first thing you need to do is you need to establish the infrastructure to get the plastic to some centralized location. The larger the location, the larger the volume of plastic you can get to one location, the less expensive the technology will be. So one company called Brightmark is building a plant in Indiana, and their goal is to process 100,000 tons of waste plastics a year. So that those are the types of scales you need to get to be economical. The technology usually costs several hundred million dollars to build. The actual processing cost is similar to making the virgin plastic. But the challenge is collecting that plastic, getting it to one central location, and then doing the processing in a very efficient way, using as much of, you know, in as low energy impact and as environmentally friendly way as you can have it happen.
UW Chemical Engineering Professor George Huber leads a multi-university plastic recycling research center as we learn about what happens to plastic in the future. Are you encouraged that researchers are trying to figure out how to reuse plastics that can't currently be recycled? If better ways to recycle plastic are developed, do you worry that our reliance on plastic will only grow? What are you curious about in chemical recycling of plastic? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with George Huber here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're discussing how it's difficult to recycle plastic using current technologies, but a research center housed at UW-Madison is trying out chemical recycling techniques that could allow waste plastic to be remade. Do you think about what happens to the plastic that you toss in a recycling bin? What is your next step to reduce your plastic waste? What are you curious about in chemical recycling? 800-642-1234. UW Chemical Engineering Professor George Huber leads the Center for Chemical Upcycling of Waste Plastics. With us for about 9 more minutes, Debbie is joining us from Oconomowoc. Debbie, hi.
Good morning. I'm wondering, why can't we use other materials other than plastic in many things, like milk bottles and, or, you know, milk cartons and soda bottles and so on and so forth? Why can't we use glass? Why can't we use other materials?
Debbie, thank you for that question. Why such a heavy reliance on plastic, George?
Yeah, Debbie, great question. You can use glass for milk bottles, soda. You can also use aluminum if you want to. I think plastics are cheaper. They're lighter and cheaper. You know, when you transport the milk, you don't want to be have to pay for a lot of the, you know, the weight of the glass. We don't put milk in aluminum. We do put it in soda, and you can buy your soda in plastic, glass, or aluminum.
We heard from Jim in Cedarburg, sent us an email our way, and Jim is wondering, what does Northern Europe do to address plastic recycling waste? What can we learn from other countries by way of plastic recycling infrastructure?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. We're definitely looking closely at what Europe does. The Europe recycling rates are about 30%. We landfill a lot of plastics in the U.S. Most of our plastics are landfilled. In Europe, they're burned to recover the heat and energy. They still don't have the technology to recycle the number of plastics, but there's a lot of active work to use chemical recycling in Europe so you don't just burn the plastics. Burning the plastic is one way to probably a little better than landfill. You're still emitting large amounts of CO2, and the environmental impacts will be a lot less if you can chemically recycle plastics rather than burn them.
I'm just thinking about that because if the end product of chemical recycling isn't oil used for fuel, then the process doesn't really reduce the need for new plastic. Also, burning these fuels would release greenhouse gases, just like our current fossil fuels. How do you get around those types of challenges as we try to you know, reduce our carbon footprint?
Yeah, every ton of plastic you produce emits about 3 tons of greenhouse gases. And so chemically recycling will reduce that greenhouse gas emissions. And if you burn it, you're going to generate even more greenhouse gases.
Let's go to Philip in Appleton. Philip, hi.
Hi, I have a question specifically about flexible packaging. A lot of flexible packaging is made of multiple different polymers, all with their different respective single units of monomers. Do these advanced recycling techniques have the ability to filter out the specific plastics that are used that are not otherwise compatible?
Philip, thank you for that question. Did you catch that? I know it was a little bit difficult to hear, George.
Yes, I got that question, Philip. That's a great question. A lot of plastics are multiple layers. It's something we've worked on for the last couple of years. They put several layers together because they give the plastic packaging some unique properties. So you add what's EVOH is what's called a barrier layer, and that prevents oxygen from getting in, helps your food last longer. We have solvents that can deconstruct those multiple layers and pull them apart. So we can pull out the polyethylene, we can pull out the EVOH, leave behind the PET with near 100% efficiency. This is a technology we call STRAP. The acronym is STRAP, Solvent Targeted Recovery and Precipitation. It looks very economical. We have intellectual property on this at UW. We're moving forward to scale this up to make 2 kilograms of, to scale this up, build a larger machine to demonstrate this technology. It's one we're very excited about working on. We can use it for multi-layer plastic packaging, to remove color, to recycle face masks. So it's a large effort in our center to do that. So
I would imagine. I would imagine you would have to have some very versatile ability here with your chemical processes in order to tackle all of these different types of layers of polymers.
Yeah, that's right. We have a whole computational database of the thermodynamic properties of polymer solvent solubility to predict what kind of conditions we need to use to extract what type of polymer. Usually there's 3 to 6 main polymers they use to make in these multi-layer plastic packaging materials. So,
George Huber, UW-Madison Engineering Professor, Executive Director of the Center for Chemical Upcycling of Waste Plastics. Carol now in Milwaukee. Hi, Carol. What's on your mind?
I'm worried about all the problems that are happening now while you are developing, trying to undevelop what has already been developed by all the plastics industries? How long will it take before you are able to recycle the way you're talking, that new system?
Thank you, Carol.
Yeah, that's a great question, a very complicated question about the time it takes to get some of these technologies to market. It can be anywhere from 5 to 15 years to get them to market. Now, that being said, for the pyrolysis approach, there's 7 or 8 companies that are actively building plants right now. SABIC has built a plant in Europe. They've announced that they're going to have product lines that are coming out. They told us they've sold, and it's a small product line, but they've sold 100% of their products. They're 100% virgin recycled polyolefins. They've sold 100% of their product they're producing already because there's such demand for post-consumer recycled plastic. But that's a great question, and one I don't probably know the actual answer about how long it will take. So.
And I would also, you need the funding, you need the time it takes to do the research and to gather the data and then look at the outcomes. I mean, I would imagine that all takes quite a bit of time.
Yeah, that's right. It takes time to do the research. Usually these are very large capital investments to build these large chemical recycling plants. Mm. And just the permitting alone can take 6 months to a year, and then you have to do the construction, and then you have to build it. And I'd love to, do this chemical recycling here in Wisconsin and make Wisconsin a leader in kind of chemical recycling of plastics.
Another question here. Mike in Milwaukee manages buildings with furniture stores. They generate tons of styrofoam. And Mike is wondering what can be done to recycle styrofoam.
Yeah, it's the expanded polystyrene, which has air blowing in it, it's about 95% air, 4-5% polystyrene, is very challenging to recycle because it's so light. And so just getting the volumes to central facility, to me, seems kind of challenging to do. You also have the more compressed polystyrene that's used to make some of your forks and some of your other materials. To me, that's easier. Seems easier to recycle because it's higher in density. I think some plastic materials will probably want to start banning that are going to be more difficult to recycle. There's some things that's done in the polymer processing that make the plastic more difficult to recycle. So there's definitely a need to understand what plastics can't be recycled and what do the polymer processors do to make the plastic that's going to be unrecyclable.
Lots to think about. George, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here.
George Huber is a UW-Madison Engineering Professor, Executive Director of the Center for Chemical Upcycling of Waste Plastics. Just ahead, we talk with a neuroscientist about the mysterious inner workings of the human brain and how we develop memories. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.